From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour today, starring Martin Ostermule. Tom Sherwood is away. He'll be back next week. I'm Kojo Nandi. Martin Ostermule is the E-man around here, the everything man. He's a web producer and a reporter with WAMU 88.5 News. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for letting me play Tom Sherwood for the week.
Oh, yeah. Well, he'll be back next week. He'll be back next week to play himself. Also joining us in studio is Mary Che. She's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3. Councilmember Che, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
If you have questions or comments for the council member, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream there, or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. We start with talking about Virginia, and Councilmember Che, feel free to join in on this conversation because it has to do with the law. Federal Appeals Court heard arguments on Thursday about whether Virginia's election law requiring photo identification for in-person voting denies minorities an equal opportunity to cast ballots. That's according to the Washington Post. But Martin, Virginia, previous to that, had a law that did not require photo identification.
Right, exactly. And then that was changed. I think it was 2012, around the time that that was changed. And now they require for voting, you have to show up, you have to have an ID. They have a long list of IDs that qualify. But that, of course, ended up in court, much as cases in other states like North Carolina have ended up in court. And in North Carolina's case, the Court of Appeals tossed that law out. Now, Virginia is arguing that their law is different because there's no proven intent that they're trying to discriminate, whereas in North Carolina, it seemed like there was a much more, maybe not obvious, but it seemed like there was proof that they were specifically trying to target minority voters.
Mary J., put on your law professor hat here and tell us what you think is going to happen here.
Well, you know, I think that I'm going to just be as frank as I can in my assessment. I think, you know, these are all efforts by Republicans to suppress votes that they think are going to go for Democrats. And it primarily affects African-American voters and others. And what it does do is it turns them away from the polls if they don't have the right identification, or they may not have whatever it is they were supposed to have, and they turn up there and they're turned away. There's evidence that shows that this is a suppression method. I'm not surprised that it would be tried in places where there is a resurgence of Democrats and it's more competitive with Republicans. So the question is it legal? I think it's morally wrong to try to suppress the vote, of course. But as Martin mentioned, as a legal matter, there are some hurdles that you have to jump over. You have to establish that this was intentional racial discrimination or an intentional suppression of the vote, and sometimes that may be difficult. However, I do think that the majority of cases that have come up have pretty much at least put these on hold for the upcoming election, or actually struck them down straight away. So I'm not entirely sure. I haven't looked precisely at the Virginia law, but I would bet that it's at least on thin ice.
End of class for the time being. On to...
Are you prepared, Kojo? Can I ask you some questions?
I was not prepared for this class at all, which is one of the reasons why you are here. The Neighborhood Ride Service, Martin Ostermule, being introduced by the Department of For-Hire Vehicles. For those of you who don't know who that is, that's what used to be called the D.C. Taxicab Commission. What is this Neighborhood Ride Service?
Right. So they unveiled a pilot program this week. And basically what it is, they have essentially vans, and they run vans in three wards, in wards 4, 7, and 8, which they say are underserved by taxi service. And the theory is these vans run on fixed routes. You pay $5 to get on, and it takes you to X destination on this fixed route. And again, the idea is because these places don't get a lot of cab service, people can't get around as easily. And you're looking at the wards, and they say it's based on the data, that they've looked at the numbers and said, listen, not enough cabs are serving it. They serve downtown because that's where you get the most business. But it's unfair for people in the outer wards not to be offered this sort of service. Now, this isn't totally new. There was a private company called Bridge that tried this for a couple months in the district. I don't know if that the service remains in place or is continuing, but it's essentially the idea that the Taxi Cab Commission, now the Department of For-Hire Vehicles, is kind of trying to play an Uber role. I mean, they're adapting to the competition that's come from Uber and Lyft. And obviously the council member can talk about this because she's on the Transportation Committee.
Yes. You know, I want to nest this in a larger picture. We have been thinking about all kinds of methods of providing transportation for people. And as you may know, I led the effort to modernize the taxi industry, brought in the app services. But there are other things that we've had to think through. One of them, you know, is to increase access for people who are disabled to, for their ability to have transportation. This is one of the other ideas. This idea has been floating around for some while. The former head of the DC Taxi Cab Commission originally was trying to put it forth, but then, you know, when he was replaced, it got shelved for a time. But the new head of the new director of the office for
Department of For-Hire
Vehicles.
Yes, I created it. I should know. It's very. It's not.
You created a very uncomfortable
yes,
name.
Yes, we got to come up with something else. Anyway, Ernest Schrappa, who I think is very innovative and very progressive, he revived it, and now it's a pilot program. We'll see how it works. I ought to also say, you know, this underserved communities, taxis and, you know, even the app services have said, you know, this is not a matter of disrespecting these communities. It's not a matter of racial discrimination. It's not a matter of many things, except it's plain out money. And it pays more to stay in and around the downtown area. Ward 2, Ward 3 are also, you know, fairly well served. So to make up for that, this pilot program will see if these fixed routes along these main avenues in these three wards, if it really serves a need. And then, you know, if so, we'll make it more permanent.
Our guest is Mary Chase. She's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3. If you have questions or comments for her, call us at 800-433-8850. Our guest analyst this week is Martin Ostermuhl. He's a web producer and reporter with WAMU 88.5 News. You filed an investigation into what was behind a shakeup in August at the Department of General Services. The head of the agency resigned abruptly, and an employee who was put on administrative leave is suing. WAMU reporter Patrick Madden first raised questions about whether there may have been improper attempts by the Bowser administration to influence the process of awarding major contracts to developers. You and Council Chair Phil Mendelson have now moved to strip the Department of General Services of its procurement power. What is your motive?
Well, first, in terms of what we're doing or I'm doing with my committee, I haven't yet begun an investigation. I don't have a date for a hearing. I have sent to the city administrator and other executive officials a rather lengthy list of questions to be answered and documents to be furnished. I need to do some pre-hearing interviews, and I will be asking my committee for subpoena power in case I don't get cooperation from whomever I think has information to
give us. What is your
concern? My concern is based upon allegations that were made and in the press that there may have been some inappropriate contact with the contracting authorities in the Department of General Services, and we want our contracting and procurement to be completely above board. They should have, you know, a list of things that they're soliciting for. The people should submit their bids. They should be evaluated all fairly and objectively and straightforwardly. And there should not be any influence from outside. Now, I am not saying there is this connection, but some have raised the prospect that there, if there was inappropriate contact, it may have been on behalf of someone who's a prominent donor to the mayor and maybe even to council members. And if that's true, then that's terrible and we need to expose it. Even if it's not true, it's that kind of allegation that I think is corrosive of confidence that people have in our system. The reason why I want to have the hearing is not because I know where it's going. I do not. But I think there's been a sufficient set of charges or allegations or claims that they have to be aired out. That's how I see my role in having this hearing.
And just to be specific, the bill you and the chairman introduced would take procurement and contracting away from DGS. So DGS would no longer have the independent authority, and it would just pass it off to the Office of Contract and Procurement, which does essentially procurement and contracting for the rest of the city,
right?
The rest of the government.
Let me say, you know, this issue about whether agencies should have their own independent contracting authority or it should all be under the umbrella of the Office of Contracting and Procurement is a constant tug of war.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the Department of General Services, which does all the renting of buildings, the building of buildings, repairs, and all the rest of that, that contracting and procurement authority, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but is really an artifact of what was used to be the school modernization program that under Mayor Fenty was this thing that he created. It was supposed to be streamlined. It was Alan Liu, who later became the city administrator, was running it. We were going to build these schools. We were going to spend the money to do this. And we didn't want to be encumbered by a lot of rules and regulations and bureaucracy. And so that was given to the school modernization entity. When the Department of General Services under Mayor Gray was created and consolidated, they got all of that. And when they got all of that, they got the contracting and procurement authority. But I want to say just moving something around doesn't necessarily make it immune from improper contacts. But part of the reason for moving it may be this issue that may be smoldering, but it's something larger than that. The Department of General Services, and if I continue to have jurisdiction over it, I'm going to start looking at it more globally, is this mammoth agency. Mm-hmm. It's this behemoth. And maybe taking that aspect out of its work will make it better because it will take that focus away.
A lot of people want to join this conversation. So let's start with David in Washington. David, your turn. You're on the air.
Great. I have a statement, more so than a question, because you know I've been following this story in the press, and it just seems to me that while we're looking at some sort of connection, we should look at whether or not certain employees took it upon themselves to change a policy, to change a law that's been passed by the city council that awards certain points of preferences to local businesses. And I think that's the one thing that we should be looking at. That's the process. And from what I'm reading, that at least one of the employees had a history of going out of his way to try to undo that particular law that was passed by the council. So,
okay. Thank you very much for that comment. There are a couple of other people who like to make similar comments. So before I have the council member respond, I'll go to Tyler in Washington, D.C. Tyler, your turn.
Yes, hello.
Yes, Tyler, you're on the air.
Fantastic. Thank you for the time, Coach. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
Washingtonian and a native, and I've listened to you for a long time. Greetings, Councilmember Che.
Hello.
My concern with the Inquisition is that it seems to be characterizing the mayor's support of small businesses in D.C. in an unfair light. And as a small business owner, I feel like the Bowser administration has been very supportive of creating ways for small businesses to get into contracts and to get opportunities that were really only going out to larger firms oftentimes. And so when I see the firing of individuals at DGS, it seems to me more clearing out some bad weeds so that we can then get a clearer process for small businesses to get awards instead of possibly ones larger ones like Fort Myers. So in terms of the Inquisition, I'm wondering how is that Inquisition going to help small businesses work better through DGS and not just end up with another
wish? Tyler, we have one more call trying to make, I think, the same point. So before we get Councilmember Che to say that it's not an Inquisition, we'll go to Jose in Washington, D.C. Jose, your turn.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Kojo. Another big fan of your show, and thank you, Councilwoman Che.
Hello.
I think I'm going to be right to say the same point. There's always been an issue with smaller D.C.-based companies. They face a lot of hurdles because the city's more expensive. It's harder to keep people on your payroll that live in the city. And all of these small businesses have always had a problem wherever it was. I think that was part of the reason that Alan Liu did this superstructure or whatever he did. So we always have a problem And I work with D.C. Hispanic Contractors Association, and we always have a problem with our businesses either competing on a level playing field or getting paid in a way that doesn't.
So you don't like the fact that the point system was changed either, Jose?
That's
is that correct? Okay.
Amen. That's
Allow me to have Council Member Mary Che respond.
Okay. Just for other listeners who may not know exactly what the circumstances are here, and I have spoken to the city administrator about this, and the city administrator has told me that the reason why these folks were put on administrative leave, and then as a consequence, the director also resigned, I haven't quite gotten underneath that, had to do with the fact that under our law, we give 12 extra points to CBEs. And when they
certified business enterprises,
certified
meaning
business,
local businesses.
Right. Certified business enterprise. They could be really big. One of the there are two like titans fighting over the contracts that were at issue in this case, Fort Myer Construction and Gilbain. So it's not as if we're talking about small businesses in this particular instance.
Fort Myer Construction is based here. Gilbain is based in New England.
Somewhere not here.
Yes.
Okay. So the point is that there would be 12 extra points for these CBEs, because they would be thought to be local businesses, not necessarily small. We have a separate program for small and local businesses. And those 12 points, it was impliedly understood, although if not expressed, it was at least implied that those 12 points would be on the basis of 100 points. So if you were scoring a bid for a job, you, however, the whatever the topics were within it that you like, you know, price, you know, experience, et cetera, it would add up to 100. And so giving 12 extra points to a CBE gave them a substantial advantage. Well, the allegation or the facts, you know, and as I said, I'm asking for all of this information, was that there were employees at the Department of General Services who unilaterally, on their own, decided that now they were going to make the point scale 200, which would necessarily dilute the 12 points that you were getting for a CBE, and that this was, you know, an improper approach to take, and that they shouldn't have done it. Maybe they were rogue employees. The alternative narrative is that these are rogue employees frustrating the CBE program and really, you know, messing things up over there.
So are you going to, for the hearing or your inquisition? No. It's a better title.
It's
call
not
it.
An inquisition.
Okay.
Please.
Fine. Witch trial. No, I mean.
Yeah, right, right.
So are you going to, I'm assuming you're going to ask Admiral Weaver, the former director of DGS, to come by, down and talk, and maybe these two employees.
Yes.
The question is, it is a really good question. If these are rogue employees, like, how do you change that sort of thing without telling anybody or doing it under the radar without someone noticing the minute you change it?
Right. And, you know, there'll be questions about, well, if they've changed it and it was only these particular contracts where this became an issue, what about the ones that they had been using this scale for before? There are aspects to these stories that are unclear to me. And the point about all of this, and I want the people who phoned in the questions, this is not an inquisition. This is not a way to harm small businesses or CBEs or anything like that. It's a way of trying to find out if the story is rogue employees doing bad things, goodbye, or is it something else? We need to clear the air. Now, I do want to say something, though, which is not in my jurisdiction, but needs to be looked at. The small and local businesses and the CBEs, there's some notion about small and local businesses that program should be an incubator. In other words, we'll take a small and local business, and for so many years, let's say, we'll give them an advantage in applying for government contracts. You know, let them get their traction. But at some point, shouldn't they launch? Shouldn't they be out there on their own? Is that the way the program is, or is it something that's permanent? If you're small local business, you're always going to get a preference. And the CBEs and the small and local businesses, we have had instances in the past, and we just have to acknowledge it, where people will set up storefronts. Mm-hmm. And
the operations from out of town.
It'll be mischief because they meet the formal requirements of these programs. They get the advantage in the contracting. But you know what? They're honestly not doing what we would hope they would do. In addition, aside from being a business here in the district, however that's, you know, arranged, what we really want is businesses in the district, but also as many employees from the district as we can get. That's what we really
do
want.
Have to move on.
Sorry.
The council was back in session this week, a lot on the agenda. The council is looking to overhaul D.C.'s rent control rules. You co-introduced legislation that would limit how much landlords can raise rents on those units, but there already are limits as to how much rents can go up. So what would change, and why do you feel it's necessary? And I know this is very complicated.
Well, I'll try to be as simple and straightforward as I can. Right now, if you're in a rent-controlled building, the amount of rent increase you can impose each year is the consumer price index increase and 2%. And in addition to that, if someone moves, you're allowed in a vacant apartment, you're allowed, I don't have quite the percentage in front of me, but it's a very significant amount, maybe even 30% or something like
30%.
That.
30%. Yep.
Over, oh, good. See, you're prepared for
landlord
this one.
Can raise the rent if by 10% if there's no comparable unit on the property, or by 30%.
Right,
if
or 30%. Yes. So the idea here is to say, look, you know, cumulatively, CPI, consumer price index, and 2% every year for a person who stays gets to be pretty expensive. And if you have significant turnover, and maybe there are some landlords who encourage turnover so that they can get that significant increase, the rent-controlled buildings in the District of Columbia are a substantial source of affordable housing. And we need to control as best we can those units as affordable. And so the idea is, instead of letting this cumulative increase go on, the landlords would be limited to the increase in the consumer price index instead of the additional tacked on 2%.
I mean, it's a fascinating, it's something that you hear a lot from affordable housing advocates. You hear from folks who live in affordable units. They say that, you know, as much as rent control is a wonderful tool to keep prices down, and it's all over the city. I mean, there's affordable, there's rent control buildings in Ward 3 that you represent. I mean, this isn't just an East of the River thing or a Ward 5 sort of
thing.
That's
right.
But, I mean, there are a lot of problems with rent control. The first thing, and I discovered this recently, there's not like one single master list of rent-controlled units. I mean, we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of these units, and there's not a single publicly accessible list. So you can't go. If you get a rent-controlled unit, you know it's a rent-controlled unit, you have to kind of trust that the landlord is telling you what the rent is, and that's actually according to what the law says the rent should be. And now I know the district is slowly building out a publicly facing database, so you can type in an address and say, okay, this is a rent-controlled building, a rent-controlled unit, and this is the maximum they can charge me a month. But there's been cases where the landlords can charge twice what they're supposed to be charging because, honestly, no one can check it. So there's a lot of ins and outs to rent control, which is
No, that's a great point because, you know, I have been for some time saying, and we are in the midst of this public-facing database, been saying we need a complete and full inventory with information about the units that we have to have, you know, even our from the council perspective or from the executive perspective, this whole variety of housing and different rules that apply and yet not have a handle on it comprehensively. I think that's the antithesis of good management.
Well, allow me to complicate it a bit more, because what you're doing is likely to get a pushback from owners of rent-controlled properties, because it's my understanding they are entitled to a 12% rate of return by law.
Well, what we have to do is we have to square these provisions. This introduction, as we always say, or I always say anyway, is an introduction. It's the beginning of the conversation. One of the things that will have to be fleshed out at a hearing will be how do these laws coexist, and can they coexist?
So, but the other challenge you obviously face, your guys' session ends at the end of December, then come January, it's a full reset, so, you know, I'm going to guess that rent control legislation will not get passed in the next 3 months, because it's a mountain of a bill, and it's going to require, obviously, a significant public hearing, and then getting two votes in the council pre-December. I mean, you could pull it off. You guys have pulled off more with less time, but I don't know that it would make fantastic public policy.
No, and it's very true. We have quite a full plate and a short amount of time in the remaining period. But it's not necessarily a full reset.
Right.
By putting things forward, you know, staffs are working on the bill. Research is being done. Even if there were a hearing and then there were a subsequent hearing, it can identify issues that are incompletely researched. And so it's not like a useless act.
Well, one of the things that's not on your plate anymore, at least for the time being, is the fair scheduling bill. It would have required employers to give hourly employees more predictable work schedules. That appears to be, well, dead.
Yes.
The bill's original champion, Vincent Orange, pulled back from it before stepping down from the council. Many other supporters subsequently backed off after lobbying by Target, Walmart, and other retailers. Are there plans to raise this again in the next session?
Well, when this came up, you know, it was being discussed, you know, hallway conversations, that there was going to be a motion to table it. And to table it pretty much means it's dead for mm-hmm. this session, because you'd have to have a motion to lift from the table and go forward, et cetera. But the primary mover of the legislation, Councilmember Alyssa Silverman, had a notion that maybe it should, the motion should be a motion to recommit to the reconstituted committee, and she would have jurisdiction over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to support her in that, because I'm not sure that there's an absolute opposition to the bill, but there is opposition to the particulars of the bill. There are some things some people like, some things that are questioned, et cetera. It was just too heavy a lift in light of the fact that we're looking at these leave bills as well, and other bills. It was too heavy a lift to sort out everybody's concerns, figure out a way to work through them, and then, you know, present a bill, you know, by the end of the period. So, but I thought recommitting it at least signaled that it's not theoretically dead. It's still something that we may be working on. But well, the council, we moved to table.
Right.
The vote was to table.
And obviously there was a lot of progressive social justice types who were very upset about this. They say that, you know, the council caved to pressure from Walmart
right.
and Wegmans, especially Wegmans, claimed that it wasn't going to come to Walter Reed because of this potential bill and the minimum wage. But again, I think, you know, I would say to them, you know, more discussion isn't necessarily a bad thing. And there's probably some logic to, you know, what some folks have been saying, that this year the council with the mayor passed an increase of the minimum wage to $15 by 2020. There's this paid leave bill, which is a massive bill and would be a significant win for progressives and for families in the district. So, again, that you didn't get the trifecta, the fair scheduling, the paid leave, and the minimum wage, doesn't mean all is lost. I mean, it could be a pretty great year for progressive causes in the district. So, you know, I agree entirely.
This is no occasion for wringing our hands and saying that, you know, the bottom is falling out. Certainly not. There have been major strides on behalf of working people in the district, and even this bill might emerge in some form that's successful. But no, we should be celebrating the legislation that has passed and is moving through.
You should know that later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker. Right now, we're talking to D.C. Councilmember Mary Che. Your council colleague David Grosso introduced the Fair Wage Amendment Act yesterday. D.C. historically has had one of the narrower wage gaps in the nation, but women still make somewhere between 85 and 90 cents to the dollar compared to men, and women of color have it even worse, 56 cents for African American women, 50 cents for Latin American women. So what's the idea to close the gap?
Well, it's one idea, and the idea is that when you're offering a job, you don't automatically get to ask somebody what they made at their prior job, because there's an extraordinarily dramatic wage gap between men and women, and also between men and women if you add racial profile to it. It's likely the case that if a woman and a man, we both go for the job, maybe we want to be your administrative assistant, Kojo, I don't know. And if you were to ask the man what he was making at the prior job mm-hmm. where he's coming from, and you were asked the woman the same thing, not in every case, but in many cases, the woman's current salary may be lower. And so the employer then gets to offer a job, maybe an increase in the prior salary, but not as much as the person who is making more than that. And the idea is that it'll be a way of perhaps narrowing the gap. There are problems with it, of course, because if people who are making a certain amount of money want to tell you, they can tell you. And if people who are not maybe making a figure that they want to tell you, so they'll up it higher, the implication is they're not making a lot of money, mm-hmm. you know, and so maybe you might lowball their offer. I don't know. But here again, I think that it's a piece of legislation that I want to hear more about. I'd like to have a hearing about it. Sometimes we do things that have negative or unanticipated byproducts, and so we'll try to assess it.
Here is McConan in Washington, D.C. McConan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I am a D.C. cab driver. Right now I'm in my cab. She said taxi drivers do not go to neighborhoods. Yeah, we don't go to neighborhood because we cannot find business all the time. And now, you know, the Uber is taking our business, which is not regulated, our fees and payments is multiplied every year, and Uber is not regulated. They don't pay a penny with any car they want they drive. So why wouldn't they control that?
Why don't you control Uber? It's out of control, according to
McConan. Two things. Is it Conan? I think that...
McConan,
first of all, I never said that you didn't go there because of, you know, negative reasons. I mean, it's a matter of economics. You go where you can, mm-hmm. can make the money. Now, in terms of the app services, there's a fundamental difference between app services and for taxis where you have taxi hailing, where you hail them on the street. Because you're hailing them on the street and there's no prearranged arrangement, we have to, and the notion is, regulate a bit more so that you're not entering into a cab, you know, haggling about the price that you have to pay. I would think it'd be kind of odd. We're going to the airport, and I said, well, I'll give you 10. No, you give me 20. You know, or other things like that, and to make sure that the equipment is up to date. However, it's a fair point to say that to... Heretofore, the taxi cabs have been over-regulated. And so we have, you know, through the council and through the Department of For-Hire Vehicles, formerly the Taxi Cab Commission.
Got it right.
We have been looking at all sorts of ways to reduce the regulation, unnecessary regulation. We don't want to regulate just to regulate. I certainly don't. And only those things that make sense for a taxi. And it has even included allowing taxis to become app services if mm-hmm. they go through that process and, you know, want to follow that path. So what I think is that it's no longer the case of one group on one side and one group on the other side. What it is a distinction between hailing taxi cabs and the kind of regulations you might need for that and going through an app service. And either could do both. If Uber wants to become a taxi, they can become a taxi, but then they have to meet the taxi regulations.
Seems Mayor Bowser and the council are at odds over where the council should be focusing its energy. She's expressed concerns about the effect of some of the labor legislation and what mm-hmm. it will mean for the district's employers and economy. She also apparently feels more needs to be done to address issues in the police and criminal justice system. The mayor is asking the council to address what outgoing police chief Kathy Lanier described as a beyond broken criminal justice system. And she's put forward a number of public safety bills. What is your understanding of what the mayor wants, and where do you differ?
Well, you know, in terms of the economic issue, I do think we have to always be balanced. We can't be completely blind to the fact that when we impose obligations on businesses, that there's a consequence there. And so I think that's a legitimate point to make whenever we're taking up this kind of legislation. On the matter of public safety, when the mayor had her public safety bill and then Councilmember McDuffie had his public safety bill, which his was primarily the one that went forward, there's a concern about what is the philosophy that we're going to keep in place. Obviously, we have to have sufficient controls over people who would do harm and commit crimes. So therefore, when the mayor reacted to the fact that we had a criminal who had one of those bracelets and you could break the bracelet and go off and commit further crimes and there was not a criminal violation, my further understanding of that is that's when that's imposed by the probationary authority, mm-hmm. CSOSA. Yes. And I'm all for that. Make it a crime. If somebody has to wear a mm. bracelet, and the other thing I would fault is, where's the monitoring? Once it's broken, all efforts should be made to find that person and bring them back in. Some of the issues that the mayor, or maybe even the police chief, were talking about are ones that actually bleed into
the federal government.
The federal government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, but also the courts. You know, are we being too lenient? Are we allowing people out, you know, that shouldn't be let out? Should there be a stronger commitment to review the background of people before we say, okay, you know, you're released on your own recognizance, or maybe you set a very small bail? I think those are all legitimate issues, and I agree with the mayor that that's something we have to pay attention to.
I mean, it seems like the usual kind of tension that exists between the council sometimes and the mayor. I mean, the mayor obviously sees that crime has increased to a certain degree in some, you know, some obviously more homicides in the city. She wants to respond, putting bills forward and saying, I'm setting the agenda and crime is on the top of my agenda is a good way to make people feel that something is getting done. Now, what always frustrates me covering these sorts of things is that a lot of times the bills that are being introduced and passed, it's not like they get passed and then within 3 months you see a sudden decrease in crime. I mean, bills get increased, get passed, get proposed generally in reaction to something happening. So, again, it's always tough to make the argument that, look, we passed this bill and suddenly crime decreased. I mean, there are certain things you could do. Sure, you could, you know, give the police department an extra $10 million and tell them to go on a hiring spree. But still, even there's a delay. So there's an interesting kind of discussion that public crime doesn't really respond to legislative kind of activities, much less does it respond to whatever the mayor says and does. It takes time.
A lot of that could be, you know, just sort of posturing, I suppose, on both the council and the mayor. But, you know, and it is very complex, interconnected issues. But there are things that we can do. I mean, there are different philosophies that can
running out of time very quickly. Sean Baker's getting impatient.
For example, like predictive policing. You know, using all of our efforts to see where crimes are being committed, under what circumstances, and focusing our efforts there, being kind of smart policing, instead of broken windows policing. We're just going to come down on everybody and look strong, you know, but it's not the best way to proceed.
As I said,
you're making noises, and I have to get off.
Baker of Prince George's County is kicking down the door. But before you go, you held a news conference yesterday on Right to Die legislation, urging your council colleagues to approve this. How would it work?
Well, if you have a terminal illness, 6 months to live, you can go through a process where with two doctors and with procedures to protect the integrity of your decision and a waiting period, you can ask for medical assistance to end your life with drugs. You can do it in a peaceful way, a time of your choosing. Nobody has to participate, no doctor, no pharmacy, no patient, no facility. But it's been operating in Oregon for 18 years, and not so many people take advantage of it. And even those who do, a good slice don't use it, because what they really want is they want the choice. They want the autonomy when they're,
Mary Chay,
when they're dying.
A member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3. Thank you so much for joining us in studio.
Okay.
Our guest analyst today is Martin Ostermuhl. He is a web producer and reporter with WAMU 88.5 News. Joining us very shortly, even as we speak, is Rashern Baker. He is the Prince George's County Executive. If you have questions or comments for Rashern Baker, you can start calling us now at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojowamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there. Rashern Baker, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Kojo.
Let's get this out of
the way. Don't get me in trouble either.
Yes, you were getting impatient. I saw that. Let's get this out of the way at the top. Are you running for governor of the state of Maryland?
Jumps right in.
Not going to wait.
You know, Kojo, you know, I did say, you know, I'll get this out of the way, that I am going to talk to my family and, you know, and after the presidential election, make a decision and to see if I can use my time and talent to help the state. And I think there's
the presidential election?
Well, I think it gives us a chance. You know, I'm working hard to make sure that we get Chris Van Hollen in the Senate and Anthony Brown in the House, and Hillary Clinton elected a president. And I want to focus on that. And then it'll give me a chance to talk about and think about 2018. And there's a lot of work going on in Prince George's County.
A lot of going on having to do with the Prince George's County schools. There was the Head Start debacle in August when the school system lost millions in federal Head Start money for a minute over teachers' treatment of kids, and what seems to be a never-ending series of disturbing incidents, including the case of a school volunteer molesting children on school property, and more recently, videos revealing a school bus aide molesting a special needs child on a bus, and this week, a nurse beating a special needs student. What's being done to address what appears to be a system-wide crisis?
Well, I think that's just... let me say this. You know, I've been asked many times over the last several weeks, especially since the beginning of the Head Start issue, whether, in fact, I had confidence in Dr. Maxwell to continue as the head of the school system. And I've said consistently I have, and I do. You know, there are things I asked him to do when he came in here. One was to get our graduation rates up in the county. They were too low compared to our other jurisdictions. I wanted confidence so people would start putting their children back in our school system. We've seen that happen. I wanted our test scores up, especially among African-American and Latino students. We're seeing a great progress among African-American students. And I wanted ninth grade promotions to be up because we saw dropouts as being a problem. All of those things have happened. But what I said to him was, if no one feels their child is safe, they're not going to put their children in our school system, and they're not going to leave them in there. So the first priority we have is to make sure children are safe. And these incidents give the public and give us pause as to whether, in fact, we're doing all we can. And I told them I want them fixed. And I want the people who aren't, if the message is not coming from the top all the way down to every worker on there, then I want them gone. And if you can't deliver the message, then we have to have a different conversation.
But you don't think it's time for that conversation?
I don't. I think that he is the right person for the school system. I've seen too many changes in the school system. We've had more superintendents than the Redskins have had coaches. And so there's got to be continuity, but there's also got to be confidence, not only in the public. And this is the frank conversation I had with him. It's not only the public, but it's got to also be the workers. So, if the rank and file won't work for you, then there is an issue.
And how is this playing for you? I mean, not politically, I'm not looking forward to what you do next, but how does it feel like when you go out into the community, are people saying to you specifically, listen, he's got to go? Because when these sorts of things happen, invariably the person at the top has to go because it sends a signal that this matters to me.
It's usually what happens is, for political reasons, they say the person at the top's got to go. It's a knee-jerk reaction, as if, you know, Dr. Maxwell is the sole person in charge of the school system. Here, you know, I got a question from somebody.
Final responsibility is yours, actually.
It is mine. I was going to say, I got a question from someone who was very angry, and they said, well, why blame Dr. Eubanks and Dr. Maxwell? Rashearn Baker asked for control of the school system. We gave it to him. It's his responsibility. That person is absolutely correct. It is my job to make sure that we bring the best person in. It is my job to make sure they're held accountable. And it's the people's job to make sure I'm held accountable to that person. So I don't shirk away from that responsibility. And that is why, as I said to Dr. Maxwell and his senior staff yesterday, you don't get to solve this problem by yourself all alone. My senior staff and I are going to be in the meetings with you. We're in a meeting with them yesterday. We'll be in a meeting with them Monday. We will look and see, because I want the culture of our system change. It didn't start with Dr. Maxwell as superintendent, but it dang well is going to change under this tenure, or there will be changes.
Here is Jim in Clinton, Maryland. Jim, you can identify yourself. I'm sure the county executive knows you.
I'm Jim Estep, president of the Greater Prince George's Business Roundtable. I've been a lifelong resident of Prince George's County and a product of our public school system.
All right. Go right ahead, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
I just wanted to say, first of all, we are in a unique place. I've worked with every county executive we've had, and our current county executive is the most transparent, dedicated individual that I have worked with in a long time, and I have great confidence in him. I also have great confidence, and so does the business community at large, with Dr. Maxwell. Clearly, we've got public safety issues that we've got to deal with, and as the executive said, these are vital. But we can work together as a community. If we start replacing superintendents and top leadership now, we're going to lose all the ground that we've gained. And I think Dr. Maxwell has the right formula. I think his heart's in the right place, and I think given the latitude, he will make this system safer, and the parents will be happy with the solutions.
Well, you obviously share the county executive's confidence in Dr. Maxwell, so thank you very much for your call, Rashearn.
Thank you. I mean, and I want to thank Jim and the Business Roundtable. They immediately not just when Dr. Maxwell came in. We were having problems in the past in our school system. They were part of those voices that were looking at it, you know, and in a dispassionate way to make sure we got the right person in. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be, there aren't those who have legitimate concerns out there about these issues of safety. I find them disturbing, especially going back to Head Start, the incident with the child mopping up the urine. I immediately went ballistic on that and said to Dr. Maxwell, I don't want that person in the school system. I know there are constitutional rights. I'm a lawyer, but that person to me needs to be out. Mm. And so people want change. They want immediately.
Governor Hogan was asked about the issues in the school system last week. His office, I know this is your pet peeve, his office released a statement indicating that he has reached out to officials with the State Board of Education and in Prince George's to understand what steps are being taken to address the issue. Has his office reached out to you or any officials in the school system?
They haven't. I can't speak for Dr. Maxwell's office, but they didn't call me. You know, and if they'd called, I'd said, okay, if you really want to help us, there's $20 million that we lose every year in Prince George's County. If you could give us the $20 million, that would help us, allow us to hire more teachers and do more training and professional development. So if they want to be a big part of this, that could help.
But could there be consequences from the state if the school system doesn't essentially get its act together?
There could be. Just remember, when we redid how we select our superintendent in our school system, we went to the state and asked them for that. So there could be. There won't be in this case because the issue is not whether, in fact, the system itself is set up right, the governance structure. Usually in Annapolis, you're dealing with the political part. You're dealing with the governance structure. No one's questioning whether the governance structure works. What they're questioning whether is the day-to-day operation. And that's what we try to get people, especially elected officials. They come in and they immediately go to, you know, how are you selecting school board members and the superintendent? That's not the problem. The problem is, how do we weed out? There's a culture there that needs to be straightened out. And that's operational.
Maryland's medical marijuana legislation has led to a fight over who can grow it.
That you take it easy on me when I come in this program. You know you're my wife's favorite.
Oh, yeah, that's why I'm taking it hard on you. She asked me to do that. With some saying that there's not enough diversity in the businesses approved by the state. Not a single license was awarded to a company owned by African Americans. Some are calling it a modern-day civil rights fight. You wrote a letter to the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland in support of more diversity. And while a change in the rules added regional diversity, including awarding a license to a company in Prince George's County, but has the racial diversity issue been addressed? Let me put it more bluntly. I think what a lot of the legislators see is a lot of African Americans in jail for either selling or using marijuana. And when it comes to licenses to sell it legally, no African American.
No African American. It makes no sense. This is, I've supported medical marijuana and since I was a delegate. I think it's needed. But certainly, you know, what we've learned, 40% of the population in the state of Maryland is African American. To say in a new business venture that no African American firms, you know, are qualified, I saw a number of those firms come through mm-hmm. the county. They've talked to a number of them. This is where if the governor wanted to step in and be helpful, he puts together the commission. The commission used some bogus excuse that, you know, the attorney general's office said they couldn't take, diversity as a into consideration. I've never, ever heard that anywhere.
And it's not just a Maryland problem. I mean, this has happened across the country in states that have legalized marijuana, whether recreationally or medicinally. But what I found ultimately ironic was not only the issue of diversity, that's a big one, but that some of these teams that put in applications and even got licenses included folks who were or formerly were in law enforcement. So used to be a police officer, and I'm not saying you specifically may have agreed with busting people for small level marijuana offenses, but at the same time, you were arresting folks for doing these sorts of things, and now you're looking to profit off of it. Now, again, I'm not maligning anybody specifically, but there's a degree of irony involved there, just like Kojo said, that you have, African Americans disproportionately going to jail for it, but not getting the chance to now make money in a legal system.
Right, and here's the other thing. I mean, we've learned from areas that have done this before. So the companies that came in, the minority companies that came in actually had experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been, you know, test cases out there, whether it's the District of Columbia, whether it's Colorado, other places, Oregon. The companies that I saw that came in that were bidding on this, you know, were legitimate companies that could do this. But yet they were not included in this new bill. And you're going to have it in places like Charles County, Prince George's County, and places like that, and no minority firms involved. That doesn't make any
Running
sense.
Running out of time, when MGM National Harbor opens later this year, it's predicted traffic could more than double in an area that already has congestion issues. Let me hear from John in Fort Washington, Maryland. John, your turn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I listen to you daily. Mr. Baker, I just want to know, what can a taxpaying citizen of Prince George's County do to get a stretch of road resurfaced that I've been trying to get resurfaced since July of 2008? And it just
What stretch of road is that?
Stretch road?
That is, it is actually the triangular section right there where Livingston Road and Box Road intersect. And they just keep coming out and dumping more pavement into the holes, and it's just bumpy, and people are coming through there trying to avoid the area, and one day we're going to have a massive series.
Allow me to have Rashawn Baker respond, because we're down to 1 minute left.
Yeah, I'll do this real quick. What I am going to do, I have a staff member in here, I'm going to look at that right now and get to talk to Barry Stanton, who's in charge of our DPW department, and go at that road in particular and look at that. But let me address, we'll look at it. Let me address the National Harbor.
Congestion.
We're asking now, both our police department, our public works, and the Peterson Company and MGM are talking about the opening, particular in National Harbor, and how we deal with a traffic plan there and the parking situation. So we're close to having that plan ready for the opening. But in addition to that, we're also going to have a plan to deal with the traffic ongoing at the National Harbor.
I would just say open a metro station there, but I would love to talk to our folks on
D.C., get them to the metro station.
Saturday is the annual Alzheimer's Walk. We know you will be there. Please convey my regards to your wife.
Thank you.
Baker is the Prince George's County Executive. That's it for the show today, but remember, there's always more happening in person and online. It's a busy weekend coming up downtown. The National Museum of African American History and Culture is opening, but the Library of Congress National Book Festival is also taking place just a few blocks away at the Walter Washington Convention Center. You can go to kojoshow.org, find a local guide to all the things on there prepared by producer Taylor Burney. And you should know that some of the festivities will include friendly folks from WAMU. Among them, producer Ruth Tam will be interviewing the author Lewis Lowry, and managing producer Michael Martinez will be introducing the author Pam Munoz Ryan. So come out, say hello, and remember that wherever you go this weekend, you can take the show with you on your favorite podcast app. We'll see you back here at noon Monday. Then we'll talk with civil rights activist and former D.C. council member Frank Smith about the opening of the long-awaited African-American Museum. He founded the African-American Civil War Memorial Museum here. That's all coming up Monday at noon. Martin Ostermule, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Kayla Burney, Ruth Tam, and Avery Kleinman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nandi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.